1970s. The other reason you say, well, why are they using this? And the main reason is because this is all mathematical and it's all verifiable. In other words, you can go in here and look at the equations. Anyone in this room, you know, that knows a little bit of math, and especially anyone that knows higher math, can go in here and look at the equations and say, this equation adds up or it doesn't add up. So that's part of the reason that corporations use these. It is not being used so much at this point in the private sector. It's almost brand new in the Midwest, as you might expect. The place where it's used most of the time is on the East Coast. Most of the companies that do this are located in the Boston area. It also is not used very much in the public sector, mainly because of cost. The model that I'm about to show you probably is about $1 million model. And typically they run all the way up to, even I know there's one that they built that was $10 million. So now let me show you what's going on behind this. We'll clear this off. And so that you don't think this is a black box with all this stuff going on and what's making it do this and do that. This is actually what the model looks like. All these little arrows and squiggles that you see are parts of the model. Each intersection in there is an equation. Those equations in the model, they're several thousand of them. This is what is known as a sixth order feedback model, which is the most complicated that you can build. And I'll just take you down to the, whoops, I don't have a slider on the side, so I can't go back. But it gives you some idea of the complexity of this. And also, just so that you understand, there's not just one little switch that's making all this stuff happen, but a variety of variables. Now, if we go back to the modeling layer, what I want to talk to you about is where this model came from, what's behind the assumptions in it, and so on. And in order to do that, I'm going to just take you down to this diagram. What actually started this model was the Bush. I was a Bush Leadership Fellow, and the Bush Foundation awarded me a leadership fellowship partially because I told them that I was interested in looking at application of system dynamics to the work we were doing with schools, because we were having trouble replicating what was going on in school A, say in Vermont, and school B in Washington State. And we wanted to know, how do you do that? So the Bush Foundation was the initial funder of this. Later on, we put together what we called a design group. The people that actually built this model were a group of teachers, administrators, researchers, modelers, representatives of education organizations, and so on. This diagram here, which I think is in your packet, is the very simple diagram of what the model is all about. And before I kind of explain what all the arrows are and what the little equation is, let me come down to this, the one point, and that is when we started building this, the main thing, and I must admit I thought this too, was you build the model around time or around money, because everybody in education talks about money. And one of the researchers we worked with said, no, what you really need to do is build the model around time. And so that is what this model is built around. And if there's any thought that I can leave you with today, it is to start thinking about education in terms of time as much as you think of it in terms of dollars. And let me explain how that works in this particular diagram. It's actually, in a sense, your old, if you're an economist, your old demand, supply-demand equation, only in this case it's for education. So the demand in this case is the time it takes a student to learn something. Everyone in this room takes a different amount of time to learn something. You know, most of you are teachers or former teachers, so you've been in the classroom, and I think, you know, most of you are well aware of how that works. In addition to that, the time that a student takes to learn something is a function both of their academic background, their academic preparation, but it's also a function of behavior. Because you can have a student who may score really high on tests and be a handful in the classroom, as those of you who have been in the classroom also know. So those two together are the main drivers of the student demand. The resources then are the time that the system has to deal with that student demand. So teachers can handle a different amount of demand. In this case, the model bases it on experience and training. So, you know, if teachers have advanced degrees, the longer they've been in the system, the more they're able to handle the time demands. And admittedly, you can come up with cases where there are exceptions to this, but what we wanted to work with was data that the state had, data that, you know, was verifiable by the state, and that our researchers told us was the best way to do that. In addition to that, you know, administration, classroom support, and other variables in the system also contribute to the resources that the system brings to the student demands. So having shown you that, let me go back to the model and just sort of real quick, I'm trying to see, it's hard to peek down here and see this. Okay, I just wanted to reset it. One of the ways that we test models, well, let me back up a minute and explain what you're looking at on the screen. The graph on the right, and I know this is hard to see because I'm having trouble seeing it down here, but the graph on the right is the graph of the resources in the system. The blue line is the resource demand. The red bar graph is the resources that the system is bringing to it. The orange-yellow bar graph is the behavioral demand, and the most important one, the last one, is the unmet demand. Graph on the right is student performance over time. In this case, we just pulled data from the MC5 reading. Model allows you to aggregate data, weight it, whatever you want to do with it, use things other than test scores, etc. Then down below that, I think the rest is self-explanatory. The what-if scenarios allow you to plug in different variables and see what's going to happen. Teacher changes just allow you to follow what's going on with the teacher force. So we'll run this just real quick. I just wanted to show you this because this is one of the ways that we test models. It's what's called flatlining. And if you look over at the right, you can probably barely see the numbers, but you'll notice none of those teacher numbers changed. Nothing in the model changed because we didn't do anything to it. We didn't add a single textbook or a single teacher or change classroom space or anything else. Everything's the same. So the model should flatline. So if you ever see one of these again and it doesn't flatline, you'll know there's something wrong with it. Now, obviously that's unrealistic. The system does change. So what happens then? The biggest change we know is obviously novice teachers become experienced teachers, become master teachers. Master teachers retire. And so that's what we call teacher movement. And that just is a function of the system. So let's see what happens when we build teacher movement into the model. This may be the most important thing I can leave you with, because this to me is the most, it's sort of the elephant in the room. It's the policy problem that doesn't get talked about a lot. But essentially it is that in Minnesota we have an aging teacher force. I don't know if you can see the numbers on the...
You know, really, all I can see is the line and then the colored bars. So I think you have to talk as if we can't see anything.
Okay, I will read you these numbers, Jen, out of the teacher box. Representative Garofalo, I see you can see them from where you are. But and I'm having trouble just seeing them from here, but initially you're starting out with 30,000 master teachers, and this is for the whole state. By the end of this run, you have only 14,000 master teachers. You're starting out initially with 11,000 novice teachers, and by the end of the run, you have 17,000. In other words, you now have more teachers in the 1 to 5 year group than you have in the 12 plus group. And that teacher aging thing is what accounts for that drop in performance. And that is a given. You would be looking at that, you know, as policymakers for the state. It's something that you're going to have to deal with. Now let's throw in a couple more variables, because we didn't include inflation, and we'll just be conservative on this and just say 2%. And you'll see we drop a little further. But again, that just follows that teacher aging piece. We know that the limited English percent is going to go up. I assume all of you hear Tom Gillespie talk. Tom's predictions range anywhere from 8 or 9 to 10, 11%. So we'll run this for a few years, leave it the same. And let's just be conservative and say it goes up a percent. It's right now 7.5, so we'll make it 8.5.
Actually, you want to go to the one below that.
Oh, thank you. I'm having as much trouble with seeing this as you are. Thank you for that. All right, now let's run it again. And it drops a little further. Okay, now let's go ahead and throw in the budget part. So we'll go 2 years, and then just to be conservative, we'll say, all right, let's just do a 10% cut for one biennium or a two-year period. So we'll give it two clicks for 2 years, and then we'll take it off, leave it out, and then we'll keep running it. And you see it just drops a little more. Now, we can go on from this and play other scenarios. I suspect that the question on most of your minds is whether you can pull out of this, so let's just do one quick one here. We'll go two, put the 10% in. Let's just go 1 year to be real conservative, back up, and we'll go another year or two, and then we'll say, okay, now we get 10%, whoops, we get 10% back. So it's hard to pull out of that once you're in it. And in the end, I just want to leave you with a message here, because I know we're short on time, and that is that the model itself and system dynamics itself is going to have little impact on what I say here today unless they change the way that you perceive a situation. And at this point, I will stand for questions, I guess.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brower. Could you talk a little more about the death spiral? What are the conditions in the death spiral? How do they stack up with what Minnesota is doing right now, and how far are we into being able to turn it around?
Well, if we look at the reality of it, let's do it without a cut, and let's see what happens. So we're going down to there. And I wouldn't call that a death spiral. Let's let's say we're fortunate enough to be able to add 10% in for a few years. You can see how that turns that back up again. So you can't pull out of it.
So when you say adding 10% in, are you talking finances or time? Or
finances in this case.
Okay.
What the model does is then, in this case, and I would say we're doing this in a relatively unsophisticated way, because we're not making choices about where to put that money. The model, in this case, the model is just allocating it across the board. So you could say, well, maybe we just want to put it into teachers, or maybe we want to put it into something else. My guess is you could, I know that you could turn that curve even higher. So yes, it is possible to come out of it.
So thank you. Well, and do any members have questions?
Yeah.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You mentioned in your handout here with the resources and demand equation, you talked about a teacher's ability to work with the numbers of students, and you mentioned their experience and education level. Now, that to me sounds an awful lot like steps and lanes. So are you suggesting that that's a fair and accurate way to gauge teachers' ability and reward them?
Dr. Brower.
I wouldn't want to go all the way into the steps and lanes, but what our research people have told us and what the data that they have suggest is the number of years experience, if you're going to pick a variable, that is, will tell you something about the ability of that teacher, you know, to handle the demand. And the more experience the teacher has up to a certain point, the more able they are to handle the demand. The education piece is just the model actually builds in whether a teacher has a master's degree or better in the model. And we found that teachers with more training tend to be able to handle a higher demand. Now, in addition to that, the model allows you to build in things like staff development opportunities, other ways of providing additional training and experience for the teachers, so you can also build those in as well.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Dr. Brower, did you serve with Representative Newton or Representative Dietrich on the school board?
No, actually, they were before me. I think Denise actually formed the parent legislative team about the time that I was on the school board.
Okay, very good. Well, I think.
And Jerry actually held my seat after I left. So.
Okay.
Followed by Kathy sitting.
Yeah.
So it's all in the family. Well, you know, we appreciate that you showed us that there's the model that can actually quantify based on what we do here, and it does have a relationship to the long-term viability of what we're doing for students. We'll take one final question, and then we'll go on to our next.
If I'm asking you questions which really isn't relevant to this, please excuse me because I was late with a constituent. But anyway, does your model deal with inputs having to do with teacher satisfaction with employment or staying? One of the problems in getting these master teachers is retention.
Yep.
And where the profession has been going, we have larger and larger numbers of people that we want to keep who leave because they have other opportunities. Is this model that you're showing us today applicable to that at all?
Yes, it is.
Dr. Brower.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize. Yes, it is, and it can. One of the variables that's in here that anyone that's running at a district or this committee or anyone else has to do with what's called teacher quits or teachers leaving the district, so the percent of teachers that leave the district. And the other one has to do with percentage of teachers that become dissatisfied. So you can build those variables in.
Just a quick follow-up on that, too. Could you give me one or two or three of these variables that you identified are causes for teachers that we want to retain who are leaving?
Yeah, actually, the runs on the model essentially show that what happens is when the situation gets really bad in a district, just the teachers who are older and near retirement will tend to bail out of the system earlier than they might have. Younger teachers who are on the cusp, so to speak, may decide to go elsewhere because they can, you know, get a better job somewhere else or whatever.
And one or two of those circumstances?
Last question.
Okay.
Oh, no, go ahead with that one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And tell me an example of these bad things that lead to that, one or two examples.
And Dr. Brower, this will be your closing statement as well.
All right. In a system, there are multiple factors, but I'll just tick off three of them. One is as things get worse, behavior gets worse, because students are not being attended to. If you think of that resource demand equation, if I don't have enough time for you in the classroom, you're going to do something else with that time. The second thing is that if you have fewer resources, so you don't have enough textbooks or something like that, that is going to have an impact. And then thirdly, your administrative support. If you lose a number of administrators, you're not getting the support from the administrators, that it also will lead to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Thank you very much, Dr. Brower, for coming and sharing with us.
Well, thank you.
Yep, and now we need the pages to change the technology and pass out some handouts. So while we're doing that, Representative Garofalo, I think you were the first one here. So do you want to approve the minutes?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes dated February 9th. They've been performed wonderfully. The type is beautiful today. Great work.
Representative Garofalo moves approval of the February 9th minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And I want to thank Richard Wasson, who is our liaison with the University of Minnesota, and he's helped us before with having interesting and informative guest speakers from the university that have helped us before often with education policy issues, but this is the Finance Committee. So we have two people here today to speak to us about finance. So if they could both come up and at the same time, and we're first going to hear from Dr. Nicola Alexander. And I had the pleasure of getting to speak in her class. Was that last summer or fall?
Last fall.
Okay, on a very rainy night, I think it was. But a very informed class that are learning, I think, more than we know here about education finance. They ask very advanced questions. And then, and she's an associate professor in the Department of Organizational Leadership, Policy, and Development at the University of Minnesota, and she'll focus on educational adequacy funding indicators. And then I'm going to introduce Dr. Seashore, who's been here before, but so we'll just have them both in our minds. Dr. Karen Seashore is professor in the Department of Organizational Leadership, Policy, and Development at the U. And she'll focus on what kind of fiscal and resource issues must be addressed in order to be successful in school change, reform, improvement, and innovation. So we'll start with Dr. Alexander, and we'll go approximately half an hour with you and then half an hour with Dr. Seashore. So welcome, and please reintroduce yourself for the tape.
My name is Nicola Alexander. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the College of Education and Human Development. I'd like to thank Madam Chair and members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to share with you some of my ideas with regard to the research on education finance. And I want to give you a guide to the presentation so you can see where I'm going with it. So I want to talk about the values that underlie school finance, how these values are translated in Minnesota, what literature says about it, the challenges that we face, and the recommendations that I would offer. And I want to start off with this quote by Erwin Wildavsky that says, budgets are human values with price tags. And as a mother of a five-year-old, I can imagine, and many of you may be parents as well, how much you value the education of your child and the education of your community and the members. And if you think about allocating resources, you think that you're actually prioritizing the values that you set forth. And what are these values that are often represented in the literature? It's notions of equity, where we talk about the fair distribution of resources and outcomes. And in literature, we talk about it in terms of fiscal neutrality where a child goes to school shouldn't influence or have an impact on the amount of resources he or she receives. Or results neutrality, where a child's achievement should not depend on the heritage and poverty status of that child. And more in the literature, we talk about adequacy. Are we funding children sufficiently for them to meet the standards that we are setting for them? Efficiency, consider the absence of waste. Or I think many policymakers think the lower administration proportion, the better it is. And accountability, where we hold educational players responsible for dollars spent and achievement produced. So how is Minnesota doing, given its current system in translating these values? Well, if you look at fiscal neutrality, Education Trust finds that Minnesota leads in closing funding gap between the highest and lowest poverty districts. This was done in 2003, and you had changes since then, so I think you probably would fare less well, I think, on that measure today. Education Week gave Minnesota a B on resource equity, while its typical state scored a C. And as many of you have probably discussed, Minnesota has among the highest achievement gaps in the country as measured by NAEP scores. So it's a mixed bag in how well we are translating our ideas and our values of fiscal neutrality and results neutrality. Even if you're not looking at those students who are placed at risk and you're just looking at how well a typical student is doing, again using NAEP scores so that we can make comparisons across the nation, we can see that while Minnesota is closer to Massachusetts than it is to Mississippi, it's not necessarily where we would like to be, suggesting that maybe there are other ways we would allocate resources and design our funding mechanisms. Efficiency, as described as what proportion of our resources actually make it to the classroom or for instruction, Minnesota spends about 69% of total current expenditures on instruction or instructional staff. It ranked fifth in the country on this measure, and New York State ranked first at 72%. When we talk about accountability, as we think about these values and what we're expecting of our students and our educators, then we need to have some way of tracking what is done and what is being produced. Education Week gave Minnesota C+ in standards and assessment, while a typical state got a B-. But for, by and large, I think the state has pretty much tried to put their money where their mouth is. And Minnesota contributed 66.8% of total revenues raised for public K-12 schools, while local governments contributed 27.2%. Only Hawaii, Vermont, New Mexico, and Idaho bore a greater share of school funding. So clearly we consider school funding important. And what does the literature say that we can do as educational policymakers to do better in areas that we do well and improve in areas that we are more challenged? The literature essentially has shifted from a focus on equality to equity to this notion of adequacy, often defined as what is sufficient amount of money that can be spent in order to make a typical student meet established standards by the state or nation. And adequacy can be done by three major approaches. Professional judgment, which is adopted by Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, Oregon, Wyoming. Statistical modeling, successful school model, or whole school approach. Another thing recommended is to have the dollar follow the child, have a targeted approach to spending, support more innovation, but have that innovation be evidence-based, and to create better assessment systems and greater accountability. And so what are the challenges as a state that we now face? We still have a persistent gap between student groups and achievement, where results neutrality is not achieved. You can still predict by and large, how a child will perform based on factors that we'd consider non-legitimate. That fiscal neutrality that we get credited for at the state level is not readily seen within districts. That we need to have data systems that allow for better tracking of dollars and time. And accountability mechanisms should allow for both formative and summative evaluation from state offices to classrooms. So what would I recommend? Continue to have funding reflect different programmatic contexts and individual needs. continue to look for ways to improve data and assessment systems, and I know that as part of your effort to get the federal grant 2009, you are looking for tapping into federal funds to improving your data systems. But as you set foundation levels, consider Maryland's approach to setting foundation levels where multiple adequacy models are used. Have localities contribute to foundation dollars based on their wealth. This will facilitate setting a higher foundation level if needed, and unbalanced support of innovative strategies with evidence-based funding. So, Madam Chair, I'm finished with my formal presentation. I'm open to questions if you should have any.
All right, and I will ask the first one, and most other members can get on the list here. There have been, when you talked about the various ways of looking at adequacy, there have been some talk, a little bit of talk, amongst school advocates in our state about litigation on the issue of adequacy. We've had a lawsuit on equity, but on adequacy we have not. And there was just a state, I've forgotten which one it was, that there was the result of an adequacy lawsuit just this week. And so I'm wondering if what you would have to say, knowing what you do about the other states and the various adequacy models, do you think if Minnesota did have litigation on inadequate funding for schools, could you venture a guess on how that might come out, or what would be your assessment of that? Dr. Alexander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to give a classic academic answer. It depends. if you think about the campaign for fiscal equity, which occurs in New York State, that has been one of the more prolonged adequacy lawsuits, where New York City said that they are not getting sufficient funding relative to the funding that occurs in that state. And they have gone back and forth about whether or not it is. So, they prevailed, and they were found to have an inadequate system, but based on different methods of adequacy, what they hoped for originally was about a $5.3 billion increase, and they got a $1.3 billion increase. So I think it depends upon how the judges perceive adequacy. I think if you have a situation where most of your students are not performing at the standards that you yourself have set, you're setting yourself up for not providing sufficient resources. I think if many of your schools are not making annual yearly progress based on standards that the federal government has set, you're again setting up yourself for not having sufficient resources, or as Hanushek would probably say, not allocating resources appropriately. So it depends on how the judges, I think, would view that.
Do those lawsuits address the achievement gap, or do they just look at the state as a whole for adequacy? Or would they say, because Minnesota has such a large achievement gap, we aren't adequately funding education, or don't they make that correlation, Dr. Alexander?
Quality for Education, sorry, yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Quality Education Act in New Jersey, which was another prolonged case, gets at this notion of adequacy and looks at the differences and the different achievements, but they looked at it in terms of the poverty levels. And so they talked about the Abbott districts, and in the Abbott districts, they tried to say that, well, if we have these schools funded at least as well as the wealthiest districts, that is a doable proposition, is what they thought. It ended up also being a very expensive proposition. Mm-hmm. And so it's still not clear, because of the lead time in terms of how policy got put into practice, whether or not we're seeing the results that we would have originally or anticipated or desired. Did I answer your
question? Yeah, I think so. And we have other, I'm going to let other legislators get in here. We have Representative Davney, Representative Garofalo, Representative Mariani, and even another one being written down as I speak, Representative Detmer. We'll start with Representative Davney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Alexander, I'm pleased that we've gotten to the issue of adequacy. And it's just interesting to note that I think the last round of state tests has half of the schools in the state not making adequate yearly progress, which may go to some of your recent comments. I'm needing some clarification or some elaboration on your point about, as you set foundation levels, consider Maryland's approach to setting foundation levels where multiple adequacy models are used. And, you know, English is my first language, but what are you saying there?
Dr. Alexander.
Madam Chair, Representative Davney. I will try and say it in standard English terms. I apologize. What I was trying to say is that there are two things that I note about Minnesota financing system, that they had a pure foundational model where in their foundation and the level that they set, they were able to set a fairly high level of general education revenue because they were requiring that local districts contributed to it in some way. So you had more dollars available. You have moved away from that in its essence because even though you call it a foundation formally, you're not requiring districts to contribute. It's a 0% requirement. My thought was that if I may recommend that Maryland, in setting its foundation level, had two different levels of floors for what would make an adequate, sufficient funding. One was from a professional judgment approach, where you had a group of educators and professionals in the field say how much it would cost to produce an adequately educated child in that state. But that approach is usually more expensive than a successful schools model, where you look at a school, see whether or not it's meeting your standards, and how much per pupil spending was for that school. And so you have pretty much a range of costs in how adequacy gets defined in terms of dollars. So what I was suggesting that perhaps if in your attempt to try and set a foundation, maybe you won't rely on one approach because literature researchers are not unanimous on what is the appropriate approach to what is an adequate level of funding. And so maybe using both approaches would be a reasonable way to go. Was I at least more clear?
Madam Chair, Dr. Alexander, you're just another in a long list of academics who found that I don't always understand what they say in the classroom. No, that helped quite a bit, and I appreciate the time. It does bring us back to these issues of how are you defining performance and adequacy, and it reminds me of the study that the business community did a few years ago, Madam Chair, looking where the underlying concept was there's enough money being spent in the education system in Minnesota, and so they paired districts and looked at performance of like districts in terms of demographics and said, okay, this one is getting more kids past the post and they're spending X, this one isn't, they're spending Y, and how do those relate? So it's just bringing back some of those memories. Thank you.
Madam Chairman.
Dr. Alexander. Yes.
If you look at work by Auden, most of the research in adequacy suggests, though, that it will not lead to a reallocation simply of resources within the system, but it really requires an additional investment. Much of the research in adequacy suggests that you will have to invest more. So it's not that you have sufficient investments, it's that if you're going to invest additional dollars, how much would that take?
And, I can't remember all the details myself, but the new Minnesota Miracle legislation, based on the recommendations of PS Minnesota, they brought in Dr. John Myers, who worked with them on various models, exactly what Dr. Alexander is talking about, and that's how they quantified and came up with the figures that are in that bill of how much, based on these, and I don't remember which model or combinations of models, if they use more than one or just one. More than one. They used four, according to Mr. Kroonquist, who's back there in the audience to help prompt me. And they used four models and did exactly what Dr. Alexander's talking about, and that's how we found out how inadequate our funding is if we work on research and what we should be spending for the results that we want with all these tests. And that was one of the reasons I was so excited to have Dr. Alexander come, because she has all this knowledge to reinforce right here at the university what the PS Minnesota people came up with as well. So thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Yes. You can call me a doctor. I'm okay with that. She sounds kind of good, doesn't Dr. Garofalo? Sounds implausible, doesn't it?
Okay, I know you're after game, go right for it.
Doctor, thank you very much. A couple of questions. One, and I don't expect you to know this off the top of your head, but there's some statistics listed on Minnesota's contribution as a percentage of revenues versus other states. If I could just have somebody email me at some point in the future where that data was listed, and maybe if I could just see, it'd be nice if I had a table of all 50 states. Yeah, I assume you guys probably have that. Just where the sources of that information are from, it'd be, if I get a copy of it, I'll be sure. Maybe you want to email it to the chair and we can share it with the committee. Mm-hmm. My recollection is that Idaho and New Mexico were actually lower than us, but maybe we're looking at different data sets. So I just want to know what that was. In the area of adequacy.
And Representative Grafflo, I would say for Dr. Alexander to send anything that anybody's sending, always send it to our staff on the committee, not to me, or heaven knows where it would go then.
Well, you're not a doctor, so what would you know?
I know. That's exactly my point.
So my question is, in the area of we have fun in this committee, so in the area of adequacy, in other states, the problem has been that those areas that are more higher poverty or have, you know, lower household wealth, that they actually receive less funding than those ones with higher incomes. And in Minnesota, we're different in the sense that the lower poverty area or the higher poverty areas actually receive higher funding. Can you address the issue in terms of where there has been, to the degree you've done research on it, in those areas where you have had adequacy arguments, that the vice versa of Minnesota's situation is there? Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not doing a good job of explaining it in a doctorly way, but again, Minnesota, lower income means higher funding. Other states where they've had problems, lower income means lower funding.
Dr. Alexander, we don't expect a doctorly way, and that was a good representative way. Dr. Alexander.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, did I?
Good. That's better than my wife says. Thank
you. With regard to the data that I used for this presentation, all of them are from National Center for Education Statistics, so they may be a little bit older, but it allowed me to compare Minnesota across other states. And so I would be happy to have a copy of it sent.
To Shannon Patrick, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, and then you had a question about adequacy. As we think about adequacy in research, we think about adequacy in the three stages of producing an educated child. You think about it in terms of inputs, you think about it in terms of programs and the treatment, the educational treatment, and you also think about adequacy in terms of outputs. I think where we run into difficulty is that last stage, and perhaps even the second, but certainly that last stage, adequacy of outputs. And so we do a good job relative to other states in terms of giving more resources to those districts that have higher levels of students eligible for free and reduced lunch or lower property values. But that has not yet translated into results. And if you think about adequacy, again, I go back to Representative Dabney's observation that we still have students not doing as well as we would like, and that we can still predict how well a student does based on where that student goes to school, the ethnic background, the poverty status of that student, English language proficiency. And so those are things that we would not, that we have accepted in the literature and pretty much that should not influence legitimately an achievement. So where we think that achievement is not innate with the child, and you think about what are the policy levers or what are the policy strategies that we can do to ensure that we don't predict lack of success for any child.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Alexander. Two quick questions. And by the way, members, I sit next to Chair Growling on the floor of the House. I know exactly what happens to her emails. Almost as soon as they come in. Dr. Alexander, two, I think, very quick questions. Is it simplistic to think that, so Minnesota has relatively high standards, relative to the rest of the nation, is it simplistic, I suspect it probably is, to think that as we strive for ever higher levels in our standards, that will have a direct relationship to answering the question of adequacy in terms of monetizing, the answer to that question. In other words, it'll cost more money in order for us to strive for higher standards. Is there a direct puller or relationship between those two?
Dr. Alexander.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. Depends on with whom you speak in the literature. If you look at Eric Hanischek's work, he would argue that it's less about the level of expenditures and more about the allocation of resources. If you look at work by Hedges and his colleagues, what he talks about in the literature, I'm for that part, is that schooling matters, and certainly allocation matters, but I'll go to a quote that said, where money must matter because those who have it want to keep it. And so it must, you know, there's no high-spending district that is clamoring to spend less. Mm-hmm. So you think to some degree that money must matter to the education of a child. The difficulty I think we have as policymakers and researchers and as parents is, well, how much does money matter and what is the appropriate level? And I think that's what adequacy research is really striving to answer that question. Well, what is a sufficient number? More directly to your question about does that mean higher standards would require more money, it depends on how much inefficiencies you're assuming exist in the system today. And so those who say we don't need more money assumes that there is a certain level of inefficiency that is existing, and it's sufficient to mean that we can reallocate and get better. There are others who would argue otherwise and say that there may be inefficiencies, but they're not sufficiently large that would allow you to strive for higher standards without getting more investment in that system.
Thank you, Matt. And so, Madam Chair, a second question, hopefully quickly. Your first point on the recommendations, continue to have funding reflect different programmatic contexts and individual needs. I'm assuming we're talking about, once you go beyond, the use of our general foundation aid, you factor in things like ELL status, obviously different types of SES status. This is a politically difficult thing for all bodies. We have a natural tendency, I think it's almost built into our DNA as Americans, that, you know, everyone should all, you know, fit into pretty much, you know, the same space and require the same amount of money, and so let's distribute funds equally. So we have big fights over this issue. And the fights usually wind up with sort of an unresolved, question about, well, to the degree that we're differentiating going above the foundation aid, where's the evidence, the research evidence that suggests that, or that tells us that that's a good investment? So what's your read of, I know it's a much bigger question, but what's your read of the field out there in terms of clear messages about the wisdom of going over and above sort of a uniform level targeted at very specific groups? And let me just very quickly editorialize, this is a real big issue increasingly in an increasingly diverse society where folks are stepping up and saying, we just simply need more resources here because of X over and above what my child shares in common with other children.
Dr. Alexander.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. I think research is evident. I mean, it's pretty consistent that context matters and that programmatic context in terms of differential cost of living, if you think about it at a district level or a more regional level, matters, but it also matters in terms of individual student needs. And if you look at work done by, I think, Pauline Waldstetter, I'm not sure if that's the particular article that I'm searching for, where she finds that concentration of poverty has a negative impact over and above the individual poverty that a child has. So having that reflected as a value, if you value equity, and you think of equity as having opportunities equalized for our children, then there is a difference in the situation that is faced by a child that is in a high poverty school than a child in a low poverty school. If you think about it in terms of urban areas, economics of education or economies of scale makes a difference to the how much they will have to spend. whether it's six economies of scale because you're very large or because you're very small, as many rural districts are having challenges in the amounts of money that they have to spend, especially with regard to transportation. So I think when we talk about equity, we may disagree with how that looks, but when, you know, one of the definitions of equity is that we treat unequally situated entities unequally.
Yes.
And so if people are not in similar situations, mm-hmm. then it isn't equitable, I would argue, to treat them as if they were. Mm-hmm. Did I?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I'd love to follow up with you in terms of just having more reference of sites in terms of objective research to support this differentiated investment, if you will.
And since I do sit next to Representative Mariani, I will say if you send him something on your email, he won't just read it once and answer it and delete it. He'll save it forever and read it several times again, which is why he's got $2 billion on his email, and I have none at the end of the But we both get a lot out of our emails anyway in our own style. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have basically the same question as Representative Garofalo. And for Dr. Alexander, that's the statistics that you get on school funding for the committee here, would that show anything how these school districts rank with each other in terms of achievement? Do you have any statistics on that?
Dr. Alexander, and it's Representative Detmer if you can't see his name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm sorry, what was that?
Detmer.
Sorry. There are data available for school districts because I was comparing across states. I didn't go to that level of data for the National Center for Education Statistics, but those data are available through the Common Core of data. There's data also available if I go to the Minnesota Department of Education. The reason I didn't use their website was simply because I wanted a standard measure with which to compare across the nation. But if I needed, there are data that rank school districts with regard to achievement.
And our time is up to go on to Dr. Seashore, but I just wanted to point on one of these slides here. On the translation of values, the efficiency, I was listening carefully to Governor Plenty today, and he said he would protect classrooms from school classrooms from cuts. And I'm like, what does he mean by that? Is he going back to his 70% idea that we protect what's in the classroom, but we can cut the other 30%, which was special ed, libraries, textbooks, school support staff, things like that? But I notice here you say Minnesota spends about 69% of total current expenditures on instruction or instructional staff, giving us the fifth highest ranking in the state on that, New York State ranking first at 72%. So could for your last question, could you tell us what you counted in classroom in instruction or instructional staff, Dr. Alexander?
Madam Chair, on the Common Core data, National Center of Education Statistics, they have a listing by state and or other jurisdiction of public expenditures by function. And they have the total expenditures, they have total current expenditures, and they have instruction, then they have support and other current expenditures. And so what I did is I took the information that they had for instruction and information that they had, or the data that they had for instructional aid. I combined them and I put that over the total. So it was a ratio of instruction and instructional aid over the total current expenditures as defined by the National Center for Education Statistics. And I think that total includes all anything that was non-capital. They had a very wide definition, that probably a little bit broader than some other data sources have used for current expenditures. So it may include things that we may not necessarily have put in that category.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Why don't you stay right there, and we'll go to Dr. Seashore and have her questions, and then in case any overlap, we can keep you both up there. So welcome, Dr. Seashore. And again, could you restate your name and title for our team?
My name is Karen Seashore, and I am a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. And let me start out by saying I am not an expert in school finance. But I have just completed a five-year study, which is looking at the effects of leadership on student learning. And in that, we included an examination of 9 states, which were randomly sampled. Unfortunately, Minnesota was not among them, and my efforts to secure funding to include Minnesota were unsuccessful at the time. So, but I do have, what I'm going to come and try to do is to put into the context, because what we did in that work was to look at educational policymaking in 9 states. And so I'm going to draw from that and say, what can you do and what can't you do according to the people in 9 states and the district people who were in the same states that we talked to, which would have been superintendents, school board members, et cetera, in 5 randomly sampled districts in those 9 states. What do they say about what can you do to change and make schools successful, of which funding is one part? And I guess that's my larger theme. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the obstacles to improvement that we usually think about. And one of those, of course, that we frequently hear in the public press, and we actually hear it from a lot of places, is motivation. People simply aren't motivated to change. We don't want to change, or we don't know how to change. So that's one common explanation for why we don't have better schools in Minnesota or in New Mexico or New York or New Jersey or any of the other states we were in. So we hear that a lot. We hear it particularly, I think, at the state level. We don't hear very many district people, and we hear no teachers saying that. So it depends on where you sit. Then another problem, which we see commonly, I think, in education, is people saying, you have the money, you just tell me what to do, and I'll do it. In general, our experience says that, A, people will say this, and B, they don't mean it. They mean that they'll take your money, and they'll do with it what they want to. So, and we heard over and over again from people at the district and the school level about the way in which they manage to deal with mandates that they feel are inappropriate. So one of the things I want to say here is that here's another problem that we hear about, and we hear about this from the school districts, and we hear about it, well, actually we hear about it every day. We've just gotten used to something. For example, the profile of learning. And then it disappears and we have to do something else. We've lost the knowledge that we've gained. And so then we get a lot of grumbling and say we like last year's silver bullet better than we like this year's silver bullet. And so it's the old, we'll hunker down, just wait. We have a gubernatorial election coming up. There may be a different education committee in the state. If we don't do much with this right now and look as if we're changing based on the state mandates, we can probably get away with it. So, I mean, this is actually, I think it's important to remember this because there are some implications of this for what states can do. And that is, really, it's very difficult for people at the state level to affect motivation, and particularly with finances. Finances are a very dull tool to change the motivations at the local level, where most people very much care about providing the best quality education that they can to the students who are in their schools with the resources that they have. And funding is only one aspect of that. The second one is that, and we hear this over and over again, is that salaries can help, but they have quite limited effects in affecting motivation. Particularly, we hear this from teachers. So changing salaries on a very large scale may, over the long run, as they have in England, affect who you can attract into the profession. If you have a starting salary of $40,000, you're going to get more people wanting to go into education than if you have a starting salary of $22,000, as they do in Mississippi. But that has to be a systemic change, and Minnesota is not a systemic state. There are states in the United States that have statewide salary recommendations, and they enforce those, and they can actually manipulate this. We are not, I think, in Minnesota prepared to do this. A third thing is that motivation is really affected by trust. And one of the interesting things we found in this is that, unlike what you think, most of the districts actually trust the state.
They think that states are more helpful than hindering what they want to do. So they complain a lot. But in general, principals and district office people, with one exception, and that is the larger districts, generally think the state's on their side. So you have that going for you. And it does affect motivation. But changing motivation requires stability. And I would argue that when we've looked at our states, states with less stable policy systems, less stable funding systems, where things are changing all the time, those are the states in which we see people saying, well, we better hunker down because we just don't know what's going to come down next. We don't know how to manage this environment. So, and that is at all levels. So there are a bunch of other obstacles which don't have to do with motivation. Do I really want to do what you would like me to do? And that has to do with capacity. And this really does feed into another issue that I'd like to raise. So we see we're waiting for better leadership. We hear that actually quite a bit when you go down to the school level, and we hear it also in our race to the top proposal from this state, but also from other states. The only issue with that is that we have a problem. If we have a problem recruiting teachers in Minnesota, we also have a problem recruiting school leaders in Minnesota. We have a lot of people who have licenses to be leaders. I would not say that if you look around the country that we have just a surfeit of incredibly talented, wonderful people who have just been dying to become principals and superintendents. So this is actually a hope that we all have. We'd all like the romance of leadership to address this. But funding can't actually fix this problem very easily. It's a very difficult to fix problem. Second obstacle, we know how to raise test scores, and the gap is still huge. And I think this comes from a lot of the things that Professor Alexander was talking about. Most of the time when we make interventions in education, what happens is, if we're lucky, all the scores go up, but they go up in roughly the same level, so that everybody gets better, but we still have a gap. So we have not addressed, through most of our proven interventions, we've not actually found a large number that address the gap. So if we place our bets on funding for proven scientifically based innovations, we're likely to increase Minnesota's performance. We all want that, but we're not necessarily likely to address the gap. So when we think about innovation, we have to think about that. We don't have any time. I want to go back to the first presentation, Brower. Time is money, and most of our policies do not address time in the way it's used in school. So I'm just going to leave it at that. We don't. And finally, there is our community union board administrator fill in the blank. It's different for different communities, doesn't support us. That capacity means that we often look at schools as if they're the only unit that needs to be changed through money or other resources in order to get better results. But what we hear over and over again is that we need to have different kinds of partnerships. And those partnerships are unlikely, I think, to come about unless we actually provide some kinds of fiscal resources or incentives for creating them. They're not necessarily work well, and this is based, again, on my 9 states. So what can states do? Some other states have invested very heavily in capacity building over time. I could name them now, but I won't. Many have not. Minnesota, I would say, has tinkered around over the time with financial allocations that are designed to work on professional development or other areas like that. But in general, we would have to say we're in the relatively low investment arena, and the Ed Week data suggests that too. I think we got a D. Many of the states that have done this have pulled back because of the fiscal crisis. Missouri, for example, had very effective delivery of professional development services for both leaders and teachers through regional centers. They're being defunded. That's just an example. Capacity isn't just human capital. The easiest resource to change is time. So when you're thinking about, do we have less money, maybe we should think about, are there different ways of investing it? And some states have tried to do that. And to get back again to Professor Alexander's point, we've done largely one-size-fits-all
and we may need different kinds of financial incentives for low-capacity schools. And then there's a final obstacle I just want to point to, which is what I call policy fit. And that is, we do hear this complaint, state and federal policies are in the way. This tends to be a voice that does not reflect the reality. Most people in most of the states that we went to said, actually, if we really cut onto it, you know, we'd like to change this and we'd like, but most of the time, state policies allow us to do the things we need to do for our students. So we've set up a we-they argument, which actually doesn't fit where most people are coming from. And I think when we get to financing, of course, that we-they argument becomes even more profound because it matters a great deal. But we need to actually address whether that's the case. This one is very important, I think. What we found in our study is that rural districts are very, very, very different in terms of what they need and how they want it and what they can do with it and the flexibility they have to move resources around than larger districts. Larger districts are actually, they have more resources, but they're also less flexible. And so we need to think about that. And size, by the way, is not code word here for urban. There are large urban districts that are just as inflexible and same kind of problems of size that an urban district does. The carrots and sticks aren't relevant. That has to do, you need to test before you use financing as a set of incentives to try and change motivation to see whether it actually has anything to do with what people in schools want. And many of the states that have tried to do that have not reached very deeply into their districts. And finally, let's talk, this is one of the issues that, of course, we come across all the time, which is we're spending so much extra money on testing because we need to do database decision making, but the state's data doesn't help us. We have to do our own testing. So now we're measuring, and we're not thinking enough about putting those resources into instruction in the way that Dr. Alexander. So what can the state do? We've seen across our 9 states is that some states have been much more proactive in trying to create comprehensive school legislation that will persist over time. That means states that are blue-red are going to be blue-red for a long time. We, I think, are probably among them. And there are states that have actually managed to cobble together reform strategies that persist across different election cycles. When I say comprehensive, I mean they weave educational finance into a larger and connect it up with issues of accountability, measurement, school improvement, professional development. What do they do when they do that? Because it's hard. It doesn't usually work very well the first time around. So they spend the next 10 years or so tweaking it to make it better rather than saying, that didn't work, let's try something else. So that's what they do. They spend more on evaluation. They spend more on data, collecting their own data about what's working, what's not working, and creating adjustments in an existing comprehensive system. They don't try to change too much too fast because that gets back at the motivation. Why am I bothering to do this? Don't I just hunker down? And they use metrics for policy assessment, including finance reform, that draw on multiple measures, I think, as Dr. Alexander has argued, that are meaningful and motivating down at the level where people actually have to take your money and spend it on something that's going to produce better learning for more students and try to close the gap. Just a couple more points. So some of the states have developed better flexible support units that are closer to needs. We got rid of ours. We defunded them anyway. We don't have a statewide network of regional service providers that can deliver some of these interesting fundings and provide support. They've developed a more nuanced approach to assessing performance. I think we're working on that here in Minnesota. So that's the good news. And because the array of tested research-based innovations that are going to improve education is actually fairly small. They don't actually rely on that alone, but provide innovative funding for experimentation at the local level, which is put through the ringer of rigorous data analysis. So I'm just going to stop there because what I've tried to do is to say that we actually have to think about funding as part of a larger package of what we do to shift and create energy at the level which you can't touch, which is districts, schools, teachers, communities, and parents. Well, you try to touch your communities, I know. So, and with that, I'll finish.
Thank you very much, Dr. Seashore. We have three members already, Representative Mariani, then Ward, then Garofalo. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, thank you, Madam Chair, Dr. Seashore. I'm trying to figure out how to best ask this. Motivation, capacity, policy fits, I'm particularly interested in this use metrics for policy assessments that draw multiple measures. I guess the question I have is, how can we do that? How can we create those indicators for policymakers? Who's in the best place to do that? So, for instance, how do I know, what a flexible school district, whether a school district is flexible or not relative to maximizing, the investment that we're asked to make here as policymakers? So I guess the question is, who do we turn to in terms of being able to have tools that can inform us on what the proper metrics decisions that evaluative decisions we need to make relative to those key elements that you identified.
Dr. Seashore.
Thank you, Representative Greiling and Representative Mariani. That's a very good question. There's been a fair amount of work done on the development of educational indicators. Obviously, some are difficult to collect, some are relatively easy to collect. we spend a lot of time collecting ones that are relatively difficult to collect, which is, of course, how much do our students know? We want to know that, so we don't mind investing in it. But there are a lot of other relatively easy ways of collecting educational indicators, which would simply involve developing statewide data collection systems around what people are doing, how students are feeling about, for example, we know that student engagement with school, do they feel like they're actually learning something that's useful in school, is probably one of the best indicators aside from aside from classroom performance, but whether or not they're going to invest their time in learning something. We don't know anything about that. So we could think of lots of ways of taking spot quick checks on the health of our educational system. And, for example, resource allocation. Are the resources actually getting to the students who need them most? I don't think we can answer that question in this state. So the answer is it would take some thinking, but we know what some of those indicators are because we've talked about some of them here. We just have to actually sit down and say, how do we do this for a reasonable, relatively low cost on a regular enough basis so that we just don't go in and say, oh my God, I didn't know it was that bad. I don't want to look at it again for another 20 years, which is what we often do, I think, especially when people like me jump in and do research and hold up a picture that people don't like and we don't do it again.
Madam Chair, very briefly, a number of us have struggled for the last couple of years about creating some kind of dynamic or entity, perhaps captured by an entity that can do this kind of work. That we feel that here in our legislature we've sort of pushed the boundaries of what we can do with our limited resources, our limited staff and time, relative to be able to brush away and provide some more clarity these emerging elements that researchers are telling us are important in terms of understanding these dynamics in K-12. And I know the chair has struggled also in terms of trying to build an innovation component inside the Minnesota Miracle as one way to get at that.
And we look forward to your bill, Representative Mariani, that will kind of tie some of that together later on.
Is it different states have handled this in different ways. Yeah. So I don't think there is a single model.
North Carolina does most of it inside their Board of Education, so it's a very centralized state. Minnesota's never been very centralized, so let's not assume that it's going to move in that direction very quickly. Other states have put it into a, for example, California's had a the Policy Research Center, which they've funded for many years, which is it's a consortium of several of the UC campuses. Indiana has a Policy Research Center, which is just in Bloomington, but it's quasi-autonomous. It's not in a department or a college. So I think different states have looked at this, that have tried to do this, and have done it in different ways. It's a cobbling project, I would say, right now.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Seashore and Dr. Alexander, thank you for sharing with us today. Dr. Alexander, I read where it says that you want to make sure that your work shows that you make a difference in being able to help children, and I think you are doing that, so both of you. Anytime we have the university folks with us, I think is very, very good to share your expertise. And maybe I'm going to ask you a question about teacher training programs, which may be a little separate issue. But I just wanted to get, you know, we hear that, you know, our teacher training programs, we know that we're trying to close that achievement gap, and we know with minority students that gap continues to be huge in the state of Minnesota. And so there's been a number of proposals as far as teacher training programs go. And I was just wondering, do either of you have a comment on that or any insight into that as far as retooling and re-looking at our teacher training programs?
Dr. Seashore raised her hand.
Thank you, Chairman Greiling. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Representative Ward.
Representative Ward. I think we have to remember that, like all individual inputs into a very complex system like a statewide school system, teacher training is only one. We know from the data that better trained teachers produce more educated students. But it is not a simple equation. So the answer is, of course, we can do better. And I think we particularly need to do better in developing a broader sense of how you train a teacher. That is, if you wouldn't want somebody who just got their medical degree to take out an organ without some supervision. We do that with teachers. You wouldn't want a lawyer who just finished law school to defend you in some major criminal case. They don't have the competence yet. We require all of the other professions to have a period of mentorship and reading into the profession while they're actually working. We don't do that in Minnesota. Some states have created legislation to do that. That would be part of what I call the comprehensive reform package, where we might say that is what we need to do on a statewide basis. Still, that alone would make a difference, but most of the teachers in schools over the next period of time are going to be experienced teachers who will not have been through any wonderful redesigned teacher training programs or mentoring programs. And so, again, we can't expect new teachers to go into the same old schools and change things very quickly. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was surprised under the obstacles to improvement, one, I was expecting to see something here that's not listed, and that is, I'm thinking of a quote from Apple CEO Steve Jobs. He said something to the effect of, if you went to somebody and offered them to run a small business but told them you couldn't have any control over your personnel, you couldn't get rid of the people who you thought didn't do a good job, you know, who would you end up with as people running your businesses? I'm just curious. I didn't see, there's nothing in there about people have, you know, I guess people who want control over their staff, and right now we've got this, the governor used the word in his address today, fossilized system, where they really don't have much control over their staff. Did that come up in any of the discussions at all?
Dr. Seashore.
I'm sorry. Chairwoman Greining and Representative Garofalo. Did I say it right?
Yeah, good.
Okay. There isn't very much evidence that there is a high level of incompetence among teachers.
There's, of course, there are some. There is in every organization. My favorite professor in graduate school, which was in the Pleistocene era, wrote a wonderful article called Protection of the Inept, which looked at for-profit corporations. I suspect there are probably some inept people actually working at Apple. And the answer is, of course, we need to have some better ways of managing the allocation of teachers to positions. It's very difficult to do that in a situation where we have a very decentralized school system, because we basically say to the teacher, you go and apply to whatever school district you want to get into. And the district says, yeah, I'll take you, and we'll put you in this school. And that's has resulted over the years, it's resulted in our assigning the youngest teachers and the least well-prepared teachers to those systems that are perhaps most needy, and that includes both rural schools and urban schools. It includes those districts, for example, when I look at some of the other states in this sample, where salaries are very disparate within a small area, I can choose not to teach in New York City, but to go out and teach in one of the suburbs, but I will make $8,000 a year more as a beginning teacher. So the answer is, you need to think about this. It's part of school finance, but I'm not sure that you can address that within the kind of finance bill that you're currently examining. And I don't think I would agree with the governor that the system is fossilized because it has the current people in it. I think there are a lot of other reasons, including outmoded policies and a lot of rigidities in the ability of people to move money around, that make it very hard. I mean, just to give you one example that you can't deal with either, a lot of the money that school systems have is very earmarked. They can't use it for everything. So you can cut their budget, but it doesn't mean that they can actually get rid of social workers, because the social workers are hired on a certain federal line of funding, and that hasn't been cut. So, the flexibility or the inflexibility is not easy for Minnesota to manage any more than it's easy for a district to manage. But the smaller districts have more flexibility because they have less of all of this. They can move people around more easily, and they do. That's one of the things we found.
And I want to thank both Dr. Seashore and Dr. Anderson, and my apologies to Representative Swales and Anderson, because we are out of time. So perhaps you could stick around a little bit, and if they have time, they could ask their questions afterwards. This is always one of the funnest and most useful and informative beginnings of the session, and we appreciate your time and expertise. Thank you, and the meeting is adjourned.